Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our minds for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now on with the show.
Welcome to Roguecast number 197. You didn't get to hear it, but we were discussing very quickly the best butts in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
And we have determined the best male butt, the best female butt, and the best droid butt. But we're not going to tell you.
What?
We want to hear what you think.
Oh, so no.
If you come into the store tomorrow, make sure, and without any preamble at all, tell the person at the counter who has the best droid butt in Star Wars.
Yes.
Teela might be a little worried about that. I mean, not really.
We might remember to tell Teela about that.
We have to make sure we have the answer key down for whoever's at the register so that they can inform the person how wrong they are.
Yes.
I will tell you, it is not Forlom.
It's not Forlom.
If they get it right, though, balloons will drop from the ceiling.
That's probably not true either.
And All About That Bass will begin playing.
Yes.
Imaginary balloon confetti will drop.
Imaginary obviously confetti, baby got back.
Yes. Yeah. So, inventory sale started this week.
Right, sure.
We've got a bunch of stuff, games, comics, some t-shirts.
I'm always happy to get that up and running. And you know what's kind of fun is when people who haven't done it before come in, they come up and I say, you ready to roll the dice? And they say, occasionally, if they don't know what the deal is, they like look at me like, wait, what now? And I was like, you get to roll for bonus damage. And this guy did it yesterday, and I think got something solid, like a 6 or 7, you know, a little bit above average.
Yeah.
And he's like, that was way more fun than it should have been.
and you should have opened up and like, well, you need to play more role-playing games.
You like rolling dice?
If I get a game
I'm going to send you to Vegas where you'll go bankrupt. Or you can get into role-playing games and have a fun life.
I was going to say, a little less expensive.
But at any rate, you can get a 35% off plus 2d6 on your discount, which is another 2 to 12.
So 37 to 47%, practically speaking.
Or if you have a rogue card, just show the rogue card, you get 47% automatically.
Yep.
Critical hit.
Yes.
And there's some good stuff on there.
Yep. There's a whole bunch of good graphic novels. There's Warhammer codexes. There's board games.
There's a slew of great board games on there.
Yep.
Yep. We have Gaming with Rogue coming up in a few weeks. That's going to be Star Realms this time. That's on Saturday, February 17th. Come out and pwn me and Dave.
Star Realms is the goodest.
Yes.
You'll love it.
Is this one we're going to have like some actual...
Yep, we got some prizes. There's like a playmat and some cards and a storage box. Cool stuff. All right, moving on to news. There was a Super Bowl.
There was a Super Bowl.
And so there were a bunch of trailers, and we're going to talk about those. But there was also some other big news in the comics world. I'm going to start with that. The big news, which came out last week just after we did the podcast, is that Bendis is, in fact, going to be doing Superman for DC Comics.
Yep. So for a little while, people were like saying, we're guessing this because he was doing the Action Comics Superman. Or he was doing a story in, like, what, Action Comics 1000?
He's doing a short story in Action Comics 1000.
And I was like, whoa, people. It's just for Action Comics. Don't panic. He's not necessarily doing Superman. And now he is, as it turns out.
I was always saying he was going to do Superman.
Yeah. I believe Superman was... I don't have the tape in front of me, but I believe Superman is what I wanted him to do. But I didn't think he would. Nick said Peter Tomasi is doing well on that, and who's doing Action?
Juergens.
Okay. Juergens isn't as, like, sought after.
No,
but
he's a solid Superman writer.
Yeah,
he always has been.
I think I was thinking that he might... that Bendis might take over on one of those. But instead, it's like a full-blown John Byrne relaunchy kind of...
Well, he's starting with like a mini-series, right?
So he's doing a short inside Action Comics number 1000 with art by Jim Lee. Then he's doing a short in the DC Nation number 0, I think quarter sampler that's coming out 3 days before Free Comic Book Day. He's teaming with legendary Jose Luis García López.
Jose Luis García López, for those who don't know, if you think of, like, the iconic look for DC characters, like, on lunchboxes and every single product from the 70s and 80s, he did every single one of those.
He created, basically, DC's style guide.
He literally was their style guide artist for all those characters.
And he's been in summer retirement and is coming back just to work with Bendis on this. And then that will lead into a 6-part Man of Steel weekly series that starts on May 30th. And on that, he's going to have artists Ivan Reis, Doc Shaner, Ryan Suk, Kevin McGuire, Adam Hughes, and Jason Fabok.
He does not lack for good artists.
Nope. Now, as always, he always brings the talent.
Yeah, even if you are not a fan of Bendis, the slew of artists is pretty impressive.
And he says it's going to shake up the classic story of Krypton's final days on Kal-El's path to becoming an iconic hero, and he will introduce a new villain that holds a terrifying secret about Krypton's destruction, and that is about where I started to get nervous.
I am Brainiac X.
The Bendis going around and monkeying with the origin of Superman does not sound great to me.
Dude, everybody's monkeyed with the origin of Superman at this point.
Yeah, but there's
Mark Waid made him vegetarian.
That's a pretty small change.
JMS was like, he wasn't a hero until Jimmy Olsen was brave, and he's like, oh, I guess I should be brave.
Here's my guess.
I'm just saying, a lot of people have messed with this formula.
Yeah, but not to the extent that Bendis will mess with things.
Bendis is more likely to take for a while.
This is what he did at Marvel. He put his stamp on things. And if you love him, then you love what he did with Guardians and X-Men and Avengers. If you hate what he does, you're terrified right now, and that's me.
It should be abstract to you. You ain't reading no DC books anyway.
No, but I don't want it to reveal that Superman's evil half-brother is the one who caused the destruction of Krypton, and that's what I'm expecting.
It could be. It could be something like that.
That, in fact, we're going to have, like, the anti-Superman who also got shot. No, it won't be Zod. It'll be some new dude who got shot to Earth, and now he's the evil anti-Superman, and, yeah.
I got a name for him.
Yeah.
Good guy, Kal-El. Bad guy, Kill-El. Just think about it.
Or Al-Kill.
Or Kal-Hell. They've already done that.
Or Kill-Hell. That's his name. That's his 90s name.
Extreme Kill-Hell.
I can't believe I'm going to be the devil's advocate. I'm like, I don't really care. We'll see.
Kill-El the anti-Superman.
Yeah, I don't have Randy's nervousness because I'm not particularly worried about really any DC stuff. From afar, I like some of what they're doing. Some of it I'm not wild about, but I don't read much of it. But I also, honestly, if he shakes up Superman, I'm okay with it as long as the ethos of Superman is right. As long as Superman is a hero kind of through and through, and they get most of that stuff right.
We'll see.
Not too worried about it.
We're getting the red trunks back. That's great. So he's gonna, and then starting in July, he's gonna start with Action Comics number 1001. And Superman number one, so we'll be writing two Superman.
Yeah, I'm gonna blow your mind real quick. I'd rather have him than Mark Waid.
That's crazy.
Mark Waid is a little too honestly boring.
I'd rather have boring than destructive.
We'll see if he's destructive. He often is an influence. I can't deny that.
Have they said who's going to be drawing his actual run?
So Gleason is staying on. Is going to do Action.
Okay. Well, that's actually a change. Gleason was
on Superman, and then. Ivan Reis will be doing Superman.
Okay.
Solid creative teams. He's also said that he wants to sort of make Metropolis as provocative and unique as Gotham City is, so looking forward to Bendis reshaping Metropolis too.
I think it's a good idea.
It is a good idea. Bendis has lots of great ideas. His execution is where I have problems.
It also depends on, if he's going to be in the driving. I mean, he's definitely the writer, but they're doing the Marvel way of producing books now.
I don't know. We'll see.
It's more of a collaboration between writer and artist.
Right. I'm not sure if that... I do think he kind of will override that.
I also don't think everybody's doing that. I think some people at DC are doing that.
We don't really know the details.
We've noticed that on most of the books coming out where the artist is a lead on the credits.
I just randomly... One of my picks this week is a DC book that I just read a random issue of. It felt fully scripted to me.
Yeah.
The vibe I got was not collaborative, Marvel style. Now, it could have been, but if so, it was so well done, it felt scripted to me in a good way. Like, I felt like the action breathed properly, but that it was...
And they're also just
starting it, so I don't know if maybe it just hasn't hit all the books yet.
And I'm just throwing that out there. I doubt Bendis will do that.
I figure we'll also get more insight into exactly how prevalent that is in the next... few months, or is everybody doing it? Is only some people doing it? Is it flagship titles or what?
Mm.
And also, here's the thing. Outside of our own opinions, Bendis' track record at Marvel is pretty good overall as far as, like, what fans want.
Yeah, that's true.
That is not completely true. Like, his Guardians run, I think, was kind of just meh received, although some people liked it. But, like, his Avengers run... turned it into, it was so successful it became a franchise series.
His
Ultimate Spider-Man one is a defining run. Alias created Jessica Jones, which is now a fairly well, really, I don't know, I'm not going to quite say beloved, but she's a very well-liked character with a very well-liked series.
Power Man
and more prominence. had a bombed Moon Knight run.
Yeah, nobody remembers that
run. Nobody remembers that one. Had a fairly legendary Daredevil run that's, you know, spoken of in the same breath as, like, Frank Miller's and Ed Brubaker's run.
True.
So broadly speaking, like, what it might mean to fans is I think chances are it's going to go over well. Yeah. At the very least, it may be an interesting bit of strangeness.
Yeah. Well, and he's also doing – he's bringing all his creator-owned stuff to DC, and he's doing a line – yeah. Like powers, all that stuff.
Huh.
All the stuff was an icon.
So those will get new printings with DC logos.
Yeah, and he said that there's a new creator-owned deal for him there, so – they're going to
forget about that one too.
Well, he said they're going to basically he's going to get heavy promotion out of it. They're going to treat it. They're marketing it as if it's their books. Like Marvel kind of always
that
felt like
a fantastic deal for him.
Because Icon always felt like it was like Marvel's thank you to the creators. Like, yeah, sure. We'll publish a creator owned books, but they did not push it the way they pushed their
right,
own books.
Right. Right. What was like a few of his, cause he did several.
He did. I don't
Scarlet,
know.
Scarlet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So just take Scarlet for example. I think if most people, if I said, have you read Bendis' Scarlet, they'd be like, what is that?
Like, did he work on G.I. Joe?
Yeah, they would have no idea that that was even his book, let alone a Marvel book.
Yeah, there was a big write-up, the article we're using here is NewsRound, but there was a big write-up in, of all things, like, was it Vanity Fair? No, it was Forbes.
Yeah, it was Forbes.
Forbes had this, like, big in-depth thing on it, and they talked to him and they interviewed him about it, and I thought that had some interesting points of view about him talking about, like, going to the Superman Museum in Cleveland, which is where he used to be from.
It's a moment of inspiration or something.
And talking about being a Jewish kid from Cleveland, which, of course, is the creator of the careers of Superman.
Right.
And that sort of that sort of spoke to him, and there were some interesting things to hear. And also, along with that, he talked about the marketing on his Icon books, and he said, yeah, DC's really gonna get behind it. It's a they're basically marketing it like it's their books. And he said, you know, Marvel did right by me, but this is gonna be a bigger push than I've ever had.
And this has always been a fairly consummate team player. And I'm sure it's easier when you get to kind of run ahead the team. But I'm not expecting him to, like, say, for instance, badmouth Marvel over their promotion.
No. But he also is launching a Young Animal style line, which is going to be Bendis sort of shepherding in the same way Gerard Way shepherds. I'm sure he'll be working with other creators.
Do we know what the theme of the line is?
We don't. It's some of his characters that he likes. So it'll be weird. Weird characters. You're like, wow, somebody like that character?
Right.
But actually, that's the thing I'm the most interested in is him sort of shepherding. Because like I said, his ideas are never a problem. It's the execution that bugs me. So if he gets some of his buddies, like I'm sure Mark Andreyko will be on that list.
Yeah.
Some of the other guys that he works
Mike
with.
Oming?
Probably.
Probably.
Actually, Mike Oming is working on Kit Carson right now, so that makes sense.
Okay. And I will say this. I've never been a particular Oming fan, but I think what I read of Kit Carson was all right. And his Thor stuff was, which at the time brought Thor to an end until JMS relaunched it, was halfway decent.
You never knew you were going to want Bendis's Bwana Beast.
I've read it.
Enter his Bwana.
But on top of that, they haven't officially announced that line, but they did officially announce two new YA-focused comic book lines. One is aimed at young adults and one is aimed at middle schoolers. And we just got the creative teams on that.
I think this
is
a great idea.
It's DC Zoom and DC Inc. And yeah, this is a great idea. They're already really successful with their DC superhero
comics. These are straight up comics, not little chapter books and stuff like they've occasionally done.
I think it's a mixture.
Sounds like a mix, okay. Yeah. So there's, and I don't know any of these creators. They're all from like YA, the YA world. So Batman Gotham High, Batman Nightwalker, which is a graphic novel, Teen Titans.
What is Gotham High?
There's no information here.
Oh,
Dave.
Okay.
Teen Titans, Under the Moon, A Catwoman Tale, and Wonder Woman Tempest Toss. These are all by different. I'm not gonna read out the creative names. I don't know any of them.
I mean, like, some of them are like Maria Tamaki and like actual.
She's not on here.
Oh, I thought she was on something.
I thought she was too, but she's not on this list. All these people are like YA authors that I see. And then the middle school line is Batman Tales, Once Upon a Crime. That's Derek Fridolfs and Dustin Nguyen, which is the Batman Little Gotham team.
Yeah.
Batman Overdrive by Shea Fontana, who does the DC Superhero Girls. Black Canary Ignite by Meg Cabot, who does the Princess Diaries.
Okay.
Dear Justice League, by somebody I don't know. Green Lantern Legacy by somebody I don't know. Super Sons, Superman of Smallville, which is by Art Baltazar and Franco from Tiny Titans. And this is interesting. Superman Smashes the Klan, that's with a K, by Gene Yang, who's doing Avatar and the New Superman. These are all really interesting books.
That Klan one, if I'm not mistaken, there was a like a movie, I think, in the 40s. That was with that exact title.
Yeah.
And clearly that we are at a time when with like white supremacy and nationalism and all that BS going on, not just in America, but worldwide, where it might be very timely. And especially with who's the writer?
Gene Yang.
Yeah. I feel like he's a good voice for it.
Yep.
And I'm glad they're doing it. I kind of like its upfrontness.
So, yeah.
This is like, this is what Superman does. He busts them in the chops.
In the article I read, additionally, Mariko Tamaki and Steve Pugh will be doing a Harley Quinn graphic novel for DC Zoom.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Pugh is one of those awesome artists who I like. Sometimes I really like his stuff, but it's kind of, he's a few and far between kind of artist.
Well, whatever book he was on last time was fantastic. Oh, he was doing the Flintstones.
That's right.
And it was amazing.
He was great on Flintstones.
I had this random issue, I think, of Generation X that he drew.
Yeah.
That I remember.
That was
really
during
liking.
That was during Warren Ellis's run, I think, when he.
No, wasn't Ellis.
Was
I
it
think.
Not?
No, it was okay. Somebody else. I can't say who it was. Because
he was the guy who did it during Ellis's Counter X thing, I think.
Yeah, and I'm wondering is if he maybe carried over
he may have stuck
wherever
around.
The next dude was.
Yeah.
And then there's something else I remember he did that I like, and then I think also a few projects where I was like, eh. But yeah, sometimes he's awesome.
Well, it seems like they're all of these books are going to be tackling certain agendas, but also focusing for more kind of a younger audience.
Yep.
Which is
I like
great.
The variety of characters I'm hearing.
Yeah,
I like in general kids being exposed to all these DC characters, like
yep.
The girls who come in the store, and not just girls, but I should say who are enjoying DC superhero girls. It's fascinating to hear them like in the same breath talk about Katana, Bumblebee, Harley Quinn, all those people,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the versions of it from those things, but it's the same things that, you know, kids who watched their, like, Super Friends show a few years ago, or watched, you know, DC, or Justice League Unlimited, or whatever, they all learn them from slightly different sources, and it doesn't seem to bother the kids that there's these kind of multiple versions. I
yep.
think that's always been a little bit of a fear that's not too big of a problem.
No, it's not. Yeah, I'm excited by this. All right, trailers. We were going to talk about there was two that we were going to mention. One is the Mission Impossible Fallout trailer, which yeah. dropped, and I think until recently I didn't remember there was a Mission Impossible movie coming out this year.
Right, that one kind of got a little bit buried in my like Facebook feed among my friends,
just
because Star Wars is going to win out.
I just
and Marvel
I guess
comics.
I heard that like Tom Cruise really injured one of his, like cracked one of his ankles while filming it. And I remember
the action looks pretty heavy in this one. So
and I remember yeah. Alec Baldwin tweeting out that he was like. Filming for it, so that kind of kept it in the back
there
of my mind.
There was a serious ass looking fight in what is it? It almost looked like it reminded me in True Lies, like the fight in the
bathroom. Yeah,
yeah, and it was
like smashing windows
and
shit.
Cool
yeah,
looking. A lot of cool camera work in there. I did think it was like it felt Mission Impossible familiar.
Well, is this yeah. this is Mission Impossible 6, right?
Right. They even brought yes. up as a plot point in it, like you've been disavowed so many times.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
how long before he like. Well, what is it like? Turns rogue.
Well,
or
it looks like
that.
It looks like he's basically. I mean, this is the plot. The plot is always that something's gone wrong. There's never a Mission Impossible movie where the mission is completed and the IMF is working as planned. That's what
right.
the TV show was.
Yes.
Right.
It's just like there's never a Star Trek movie where they just discover a new planet.
Right.
When you're doing movies, the scale has to be a little bigger, and therefore
something is going to be threatening, destroying a whole bunch of
something's got to destroy the whole premise,
and Ethan has to go rogue with his team.
Yeah,
but this looks like it's basically him going up against like maybe the CIA, maybe MI6, maybe both.
Yeah. Did they say in the beginning like it's kind of a little stinger, just line? Do they say has there ever been a mission you declined?
They did. They said, did you ever not take a
but
mission?
But it also
yet?
Looks
yeah.
like they're bringing in a lot of the continuity from the past movies
yeah.
because. We get the
At this
femme
point,
fatale
the continuity
of the last.
Is kind
of
tight.
We've got the femme fatale from the last one, sort of being an adversarial in this one. The girl. Which
yep.
is,
and I was worried that
that's
Simon
Rogue Nation.
Yeah. Yes. And as I was watching it, I was thinking, no Simon Pegg, but he shows up.
Oh yeah, Simon Pegg.
So,
and also,
yeah,
I thought it was
Pegg.
Really cool that they brought his wife back.
Oh yeah,
Michelle.
Wait, she's not in this.
Yes, she is. She's in the trailer. She's
oh,
in the,
I didn't
she's
notice.
She's towards the end with Bing
Rhames. She looks a lot like I think it's Rebecca Ferguson, who is the British spy.
She's the British spy,
and yeah. I didn't realize that.
And it's Michelle
Monaghan.
Yeah,
I forgot she was back.
She shows up at the end of the trailer.
I feel like you know before this hits, I might actually have to do a little marathon. Just gently leap over number two.
Here's the thing.
That's a good call.
The
because number two is number two.
The premises of all these is always the same, but. We have a friend, Jake Eckes, who was making the point, I think, about this and Marvel movies both, that there's something to be said for movies that are okay with being formulaic. Like, if you do something well, it's okay to keep doing it the same way.
Right.
And so Mission Impossible
right.
always
it's the
offers
nature of kind of comfort food entertainment.
It always offers up great action, a solid enough plot and some good character stuff.
There's some surprise twists and turns. They almost always do some twist and turny stuff.
And a little nod to continuity, like there's always little nods to things, like in Ghost Protocol, where he sees his wife at the end because they're harkening back to when he had to sort of fake his death in three. And there's always little bits of that. There's just stuff with Jeremy Renner that runs through 4 and 5.
Yeah.
And it's easily compared to something like Fast and Furious. Yeah, it's kind of dumb, but it does its action well, and the characters are likable.
I'm kind of sad Jeremy Renner's not going to be in this one. I liked him too. In the previous one.
You know, I have to say that, honestly, I feel like these movies are a little bit, for me, better than the Bond movies.
I agree.
Yeah. Like, just to look at the recent ones, all the... Daniel Craig. I was about to say Craig Ferguson. I'm like, that's not right.
No.
Daniel Craig Ferguson.
Daniel Craig Ferguson.
It feels like the Bond movies are kind of skewing to more realistic. They're forgetting kind of their larger-than-life
In their way, but they're still larger-than-life.
They're still
spies. Actually okay with their slightly edgier tone. You know, it'll change when they get a new actor
in. But gone are the days of when Bond would be using, like, masks and all, like, the gadgetry, IMF is all about that.
Yeah, kind of right. Thing. And I have to say, they come up with super fun ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The mirror one that they did in Ghost Protocol. Yeah, the big hologram thing. That was the coolest thing. Such a good scene.
Also, Mission Impossible, while it's always a Tom Cruise joint, it is an ensemble to some extent. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that Bond may have Moneypenny and M and all that kind of stuff, but Bond is still, he's the agent.
Yeah.
And so the notion of having other field agents, I think, is one of the things I like about this.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the things I liked best about Spectre was having Moneypenny and M and Q all kind of more actively involved in the mission, which makes it more like Mission Impossible.
Yeah, yeah. I'm looking forward to this. I think the trailer
looks fun.
Yeah.
I'm down for it.
And then the other trailer was the Solo A Star Wars, which we got a teaser for the trailer and then the actual trailer.
You know what's fascinating to me about that?
That
the teaser was not just glimpses of stuff from the main trailer.
It was a different
trailer. Yeah, they were basically two different, like, there was like a little, it's like a micro teaser and then a full teaser trailer.
I agree, and that's why I mentioned the teaser and the trailer, because usually the teaser is just the dumb, like, hey, here's some flash of things you're gonna see tomorrow.
Tune in tomorrow.
Yeah, you should watch both of these.
This teaser was it was like this is him at very young, like joining the Imperial Academy.
Yeah, they like show his like recruitment process with a kind of bored sort of Imperial officer.
Yeah.
Taking his doing the recruiting thing, and this is in the micro teaser.
Yeah, and then the trailer is all about like a heist. It looks like a space heist, which by the way is exactly what I want out of a Solo movie, of course, because I love heist movies, but. Yeah. Like this,
it's also what I wanted out of Rogue One.
Yeah, me too. And that's so you got Lando looking bomb as hell. Donald Glover's fur coat is already. I'm sure it already has fans.
Oh
these days. Whenever I see stuff, I'm like, I'm also looking at the cosplay of tomorrow.
Yep.
So as I'm watching Star Trek Discovery and the Orville, I'm like, okay, these are going to be all over conventions.
Yeah.
The next one, next time.
You're going to get a Lando fur coat.
Oh, for sure.
Totally. It's probably, I'm sure, in the works right now for somebody's going to get it at a convention in the next few weeks.
But again, these trailers are sort of...
Also, he's going to bring back mustaches.
Yeah.
But we're getting sort of that weird kind of skew of... Everyone is either loving it or hating it at this point.
I loved it. I'm super on board. It's like I say, it's a heist in space.
But
it's
Everybody was like very like, there was a lot of murmurings that this movie was going to stink because it has, I guess, seemingly had rough production than what the director left.
Yeah, they changed directors. Ron Howard took over.
Yeah, Ron Howard, if somebody's going to take it, if you got to have somebody take over your movie, that guy's as rock solid as you can get.
Yeah, Ron Howard may not always be that exciting, but he's always solid.
Yeah. I guess he's lately been doing, like, the Da Vinci Code stuff was kind of his thing, his franchise. He did all those, I think all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's probably had various other kind of more personal projects, too. But he knows how to direct action and suspense and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, no, I think he'll be fine. But
it is true. The movie is only, like, a few months out?
Yeah.
And this is the very first we've glimpsed
it.
Isn't
that May?
The posters were just now hitting, too. They're nice, colorful posters, I think.
Oh, those posters are great.
They're all stylish. But people, like, 2 weeks ago, everybody was like, this movie is going to suck. Sorry, just brace for it.
Yep.
And now, I'm like, whoa, that looked cool.
I was never in the camp of thinking it was going to suck. I think at this point, like Star Wars and Marvel movies, at this point, I'm like, the worst you're going to get is it's not as great as everybody says it is. But they've got their factory set up.
I also think it's something like well, that's not what I would have wanted to see.
Right.
Like, there's going to be some people who are like, oh, I don't want to see a Han Solo heist story. I wanted to see all about him. I don't know, his love life. I don't know.
I want to see his wife start becoming called Han Solo. I want to see his younger days when he was Han Duo. Dave, what I think is interesting is you and I, neither of us are fans of, say, Rogue One. Well, you liked Last Jedi more than me.
Yeah.
But neither of us loved Rogue One.
Correct.
And I didn't love Last Jedi.
Right.
But I would not say either one is a bad movie.
Right.
They both do what they do well.
I might argue that Rogue One actually is kind of feels a little sloppy to me.
Mm.
Like, it has a certain the veneer of slickness. Mm. But I would say that there were some...
And I rebut that.
Some choices...
I guess my point is, Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Rogue One, basically everything Disney has made with Star Wars.
I don't expect them to ever fully drop the ball. They're going to maintain a certain level of consistent quality and craft.
Yeah, compare them to the prequels, and you're like, okay, well, even if you're one of those people who likes the prequels better than those movies, first of all, you're wrong. Second of all, you're very much against the sort of the cultural zeitgeist at that point. And I think Disney has, if nothing else, figured out a way to tap into the cultural zeitgeist and make solid product, even if it's not great. So right. I would expect nothing less than good from Solo, and it might be something that I really love.
Yeah. And what is interesting is that there are definitely contingents that loved Rogue One. Nick, would you say you loved Rogue One?
Love might be too strong, but I really, really, really liked it.
There are numerous people who consider Rogue One their favorite Star Wars movie.
And yeah, I know I have a number of friends who do. And likewise, although I also have no folks who didn't like Last Jedi, I know a number of people who loved Last Jedi.
It's their favorite Star Wars movie,
and
yeah.
I would say I really liked it. I can't quite push it into the love category because I didn't feel as the emotional resonance as much as I did with Force Awakens.
Yeah.
But I really liked it.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is though the thing I imagine that people are going to find out that Star Wars can contain more than they thought it could,
and that makes sense to me.
I always would have thought they would have kind of started learning that from the prequels, even though the prequels stumbled a bit. They were a pretty different style than the original ones. Like I kind of thought it would have braced us for it, but
especially the prequels
for better versions.
They were so bad that I think people were thinking, or at least so critically. Hated.
Yeah.
That I think people are like, oh, I guess there isn't more to Star Wars.
Yeah.
I think that's what, because the prequel sort of showed it was so different. If you're like, oh, this doesn't work, maybe it only works if you do the original trilogy thing.
Some of the same people I think who are probably having issues with Star Trek Discovery who are like, that's not what Klingon ships look like.
Yeah.
I'm doing a little bit of that too, but I'm like, a good story is going to get me through this.
Yeah.
And also, those guys. Right now, all the Klingon houses are fighting, and it could well end up that things that ship the ship style that we were used to could still come along.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, like when some Klingon house gains ascendancy, I'm not going to flip my ship.
Yeah. But
just a little bit.
Talking about Star Wars being able to contain multitudes, in addition to the finale of the Skywalker trilogy, which J.J. Abrams is going to do. We already had the Rian Johnson trilogy announced, which is going to be completely new characters and maybe a new part of the universe.
That's going to be like the craziest thing, that maybe the scariest thing in some ways is seeing a whole new cast.
Well, and at the same time, they just announced that Benioff and Weiss from Game of Thrones are making a trilogy of Star Wars films, not related to either one of those trilogies.
Yeah.
So they're going to launch, and who knows, that might be after. Like, they may have just early announced it, but I could see them doing two Star Wars movies a year.
People, do you like Imperial Walkers? Do you like TIE Fighters? Do you like things in space.
Yeah.
They are going to hook you up.
Yeah. I'm excited to see what Benioff and Weiss do with the Star Wars trilogy. I think those guys have a lot of vision.
You know what I want? I want some cool, do you remember Tim Truman did this story? He was kind of fascinated with the Tusken Raiders.
Yeah,
that's right. I think they tied in a little bit with his love of Native Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I would not mind seeing that brought into play either as part of an ensemble or something like, I want to see something with, one of the Sand People.
Well, I think they could introduce a ton of new elements. It's Star Wars. There's plenty of things you can do in that universe. So
we could have a story set entirely on a, like Vice Den world in the Outer Rim or whatever, or, a story about space pirates, a story about anything.
Yeah. I'm excited about that, and hopefully also that also means that their stupid Civil War HBO alternate history is killed.
I hope so.
Because that's a terrible idea.
I actually would like to see essentially a sort of crime mob story set in and around, like, intersecting with the huts, but not not solely set in them.
Yeah.
It's about some maybe some morally gray characters.
Just sort of a scum and villainy kind of.
Yeah, a little bit of a Star Wars Godfather. Maybe with a little bit more, a slightly more heroic bent to it.
I can see that, but I think the problem is we're already seeing like. Solo is sort of in that world.
Yeah.
Rogue One was a little bit in that world. Like, I don't want it to all be about the crime side of the Star Wars universe.
Same.
I want to see.
You ready for romance?
I want to see something else. I think just like Kevin Feige took Marvel's superheroes and said superheroes not a genre, superhero is a flavor, and you do a genre as well.
Right.
I would like him to do the same thing with Star Wars. Like, it doesn't have to be a sci-fi genre. You can just do different stories.
How about this? Pod racer type stuff. It's basically Days of Thunder Star Wars.
Yeah, I'd watch that.
Yeah.
I'd watch that. I don't know exactly what I want them to do, but I would like them to do some, you know, I'd love to see some Jedi history stuff. All of that is expanded universe, and of course would drive people crazy to be messing with that. But I would love
go
to
back
see some...
and show the earliest...
Yeah, go show us a little more of the Jedi stuff, because the prequels really kind of hose the Jedi.
Wouldn't it be kind of crazy if the guys who did Game of Thrones did the Knights of the Old Republic?
The thing is, I don't want them to do Knights of the Old Republic. I want them to go back and do something in that era that is different.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying, but
yeah,
that era.
But that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. I think
that'd be interesting, yeah. And I can see it. I think that there's plenty of room to move up and down the timeline.
Yeah.
And to not just go to the fringes of the galaxy, but show us what was going on in other parts of the timeline.
Would freak a lot of people out.
Yeah, yeah. So.
No, don't touch my Star Wars.
Conan the Barbarian is getting a series on Amazon. It's a TV series.
Geeks did take over the world, didn't they?
They did, yes.
Oh, very much so.
So this is the co-creator of the show Colony, which I don't think was great.
Oh,
but,
the USA thing with Sawyer from Lost?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was solid.
Okay.
I enjoyed it, and it's on Netflix and definitely worth watching.
Game of Thrones director Miguel Sapochnik, Fargo and The Handmaid's Tale executive producer and former NBC head Warren Littlefield. That's a good bunch of creative team. I can totally see a good Conan show.
Yeah. I think especially if they hew closer to the books where, you know, Conan was a more well-rounded guy. He was kind of more of a sly and canny sort of warrior.
Yeah.
Not always just the brute.
All I ask is it better than the last movie outing?
Yeah, that stunk.
Yeah.
I watched it, but I think it was one of those, like, fast-forward watchings.
Yeah.
I'm 100% sure it will be. I actually feel that kind of
yeah.
I can't say that.
Yeah.
By the way, if you had like let's say you told 12-year-old Dave that there will be super like high budget, best, you know, like top-notch writing teams producing a Conan series, a Lord of the Rings series is going to happen too, I guess.
Yep.
I think that's still going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That there will be great Marvel movies. I'm trying to think what else, like all these other genre shows that are going on.
Yeah, it's a golden age.
For geeky sort of genres.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So Gaumont, which is a French film company, has picked up Usagi Yojimbo for an animated series.
Yeah.
Now this is interesting because Gaumont is, they've done a lot of weird stuff. They've been around for like, 100 years. But the stuff they've done, they did Highlander, the animated series, and a bunch of stuff you've never heard of. Space Goofs, The Magician, Dragonflies.
Okay. Are these overseas shows?
No, they were all done. They were all done for American TV.
Okay, but
here's,
there were things that became nothing.
Here's their most recent thing. Well, I've heard the Highlander animated series was good. Their most recent thing was that they co-produced Hannibal and Hemlock Grove.
Yeah.
So they've done some notable stuff, but... What's interesting is the notion of Usagi getting an animated series is fantastic.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is that, it's a very episodic series, but it always does have those sort of big mythology things that are running through it.
Yep.
I think it's very adaptable.
Yeah, I can see so too.
If it gets people excited for that property and in turn gets people turning to the comics, which is great.
Well,
it's
such a visual comic. Like, I can totally see them doing a really cool animated series.
But it's also like when you think about the cast of, so you got Usagi, you got, is it Gen?
Yeah.
I can't think of the
Emperor. Tomo. I mean, there's a ton of great characters
right,
in there.
Right, yeah. There's...
Here's just a personal question. Would you want it in sort of the Sakai style of art?
Yeah,
I would certainly want it in the ballpark and not like, say, if it was CG with rendered fur that looked like hyper real fur.
Although that said, I can see a version that takes Sakai's imagery and adds a 3D CGI element to it.
Yeah, like what if it looked like broadly like a Zootopia kind of animal?
Yeah, see that kind of thing I can totally see.
Yeah, I guess that could work out.
I'm just curious. I'm up for
I want
any...
him to look like Reboot.
I want them to look like the Dire Straits music video.
But just like with rabbit ears.
With rabbit ears.
And like
yes.
a sword.
Yeah.
Rubber
yeah. All right. That takes care of news for the week. We'll be back in just a minute with comics.
We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, February 7th, and it's X-Men Day.
It is X-Men
Day. There's a bunch of X-Men books this week.
That's true.
And the biggest one is the one that is my pick, which is X-Men Red, number one.
The anticipated new X-Men team led by Jean Grey?
Yeah. So X-Men Blue and Gold is a harking back to Jim Lee. That was the thing that they did, the Blue and Gold team.
Right.
Red is a new thing.
Well, to Jim Lee and Chris Claremont, not like just Jim Lee.
Yeah, but I feel like Jim Lee was mostly calling the shots, and Claremont was on his way out the door.
I guess he was doing the last
only
few.
He did seven issues of that book, and then he was gone.
Yeah. So. I'm just saying, like, I feel like those books are better than Jim Lee.
Oh, no. I agree, but I also think they're not the best of Claremont. I feel like it was his... I think he was on his way. I feel like Jim Lee co-wrote half that book.
Yeah.
Anyway, they haven't done a Red book. The notion of adding another color... at first, I would have resisted. If this had been anybody that's still writing, I would have been like, I don't know about this. I'm also, as previously discussed like a couple weeks ago, I'm not a huge Jean Grey fan. But you get Tom Taylor, who is probably my favorite writer, or at least one of my favorite writers, and he does a new X-Men book. I'm going to be interested. And the result here, I really, really liked. First of all, he brings in all new Wolverine and Honey Badger from his Wolverine book.
Yeah.
So that was cool. He brings in Nightcrawler, who I really like to see written well, and he's written well here. And his Jean Grey is sort of she's sort of grown up into more almost a Professor X type here.
Yeah.
She's got a little more telepathic power. She is like an inspirational leader.
Yeah, she kind of seems to have a vision.
Yeah. And we actually start with a thing. We start with a little intro that's like an action. It's like the James Bond sequence. That is she's put the team together. She's got new costumes. There's a couple new characters you've never seen before, or probably not seen before, like Gentle and Trinary, one of whom is brand new, one of whom was introduced in a Black Panther story. And they rescue a little girl from an anti-mutant mob that actually includes a little girl's mom in a pretty harrowing sequence. And we see that, her team is like... They're like rescuing young mutants, which gives them a different mission statement than X-Men Gold or X-Men Blue.
Right.
And then we flash back to sort of how this team formed 2 months earlier, and there's a carjacking, there's a baby who develops mutant powers, which is a fairly rare thing. There's some good team stuff with Jean Grey and Nightcrawler and Wolverine, and then a sort of mission statement where Jean decides she's going to make a new kind of mutant team. And I griped about Namor being on this team.
Yeah.
Because I do not like Namor as a mutant, and I don't think he belongs in the X-Men. But once I saw where they were going with the premise, and they brought Namor in, I was like, oh, that's why Namor's involved.
Yeah.
And there's also a guest star from Black Panther, and that makes sense too. And I really like the sort of hopeful tone of this book. I like the premise of it. I really like the notion of Jean trying to redeem what she did as Phoenix.
Yep. Right, and as people noted, it's like, well, or I guess Black Panther's talking to her, which I kind of like seeing him in there.
Yeah.
He's like, that wasn't you, that was the Phoenix entity, and she's like, but I was part of that.
Yeah.
So whether she was like truly, had any role or not, of course she would feel that guilt.
And there's this great scene where she brings together all these people and uses her telepathic powers in a way I've not seen it before.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really cool idea, and then she sort of shares that with Nightcrawler. I love the stuff with her and Nightcrawler. Tom Taylor always does character stuff really well. And I thought his moments with Jean and Nightcrawler was like some of the best I've seen of both those characters.
He does a couple things. I mean, the character stuff is amazing, but I love him playing in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, me too.
And it's not just the X-Men universe. When he writes a book that takes place in the Marvel Universe, he's using every aspect that he can.
The other thing I like about this, there's no fight in this book. There's a couple action sequences where they deal with powers. But there's not a big fight. Instead, this is the X-Men as Rescue Squad, which harkens back to what Grant Morrison did.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I like the idea of the X-Men not just being the guys who wreck a place in a fight with the Marauders, but who are actually supposed to be inspiration, who are trying to be sort of the bringing the dream together of the human
genius. Genius trying to restructure what it means to be an X-Men, and, yeah. I liked that a lot.
Yeah. I always question the need for multiple X-Men books, and this one I'm like, oh, this has a different reason for being. It also has a surprise villain, which I was super happy to see, and I thought was a was gonna be an interesting challenge for Jean Grey. So yeah, I'm all about this book. No surprise, I've been anticipating it, but I wasn't sure if it was gonna click with me, and it really, really did.
And I'm gonna steal the show for a minute because I want to talk about my X-Men book.
Keep the X-Men.
Yeah, keep the X-Men train going. Yeah. I'm picking the second issue of Rogue and Gambit.
Which I think we all liked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was not blown away by the first issue. I thought it was solid.
Yeah.
This issue I liked even more because it sort of delved deeper into the relationship between the two characters. Mm-hmm. It's not a jokiness in tone.
Just real quick to like throw out the premise, they're infiltrating a couples therapy spa retreat. Kind of retreat. Yeah, yeah. And because there's weird missing people and mutant stuff related to it, and they're trying to uncover it, but the backdrop is that it's kind of allowed that like they have to attend the classes and kind of stay in the same room, and it's a kind of a clever little forced premise to have them talk about their relationship and stuff.
Which their relationship is kind of mucked up. Sure. I mean, it is weird.
In the truest superhero comic sense of like many writers have written it, they've had different angles.
Yeah.
And it, you know, the net effect though is that they would be the equivalent of a kind of like on again, off again, semi toxic couple that just can't stay together.
Especially in like the
but can't stay apart.
Like the big splash page that happens on page 2 and 3, which is speech bubbles of them yelling at each other, but they're visually done from instances from throughout their past.
Right, it's like a visual montage.
So it has like
of all their big past.
Like
moments.
Rogue kissing Deadpool. There's stuff from the X-Men number I think it was 3 or 4 of when Claremont where the Rogue and Gambit go out on their big date.
Is this the thing with the cliff? Is that from a backup story of classic X-Men where she like kissed that? No, she wouldn't have been able to fly then.
I don't know,
but I recognize that.
And there's a scene from Extreme X-Men where they were killed. Then there's
it happens.
Gambit
happens.
Dealing with one of his ex-lovers.
Yeah, stupid Deadpool.
Yeah, stupid Deadpool. anyways. I think I connected most of this because I've always liked Rogue and Gambit, and seeing them written well by Kelly Thompson is really nice. Because
I've never liked them as a couple, but I liked them here.
Because not only does it do that, but it also has them telling them about their first meeting, and how,
which is an interesting point of contention between them, and the story explores why.
And it also has Gambit in his best X-Men costume ever.
I'm the only one who thinks that.
It is a great costume.
But it's not his best costume ever.
It is his best costume.
Nick likes pouches. He likes the 90s.
This doesn't even have any pouches.
You told me that's why you like
it? He has a satchel. Which is cool.
You like one puffy pouch.
I like one puffy pouch over 10,000 like pouches 10,000. That Cable has.
Yes, okay.
I like the singular pouch.
All right. Well, you've got a philosophy and you're sticking
to it. And he still has his trench coat.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a point of contention for both of them. I like seeing each one choose their story and kind of backing it up a little bit. And of course, the larger story gets progressed as well, but I don't know. I think it's just a really fun story, told very well with beautiful art by Pere Perez.
It's a good mixture. It's kind of got lighter tones at times. There's times when they kind of are bantering a little bit.
Yep.
And then there's times when it obviously ticks into a more serious territory and it's like more like real couples kind of arguing over real stuff.
It's more personal.
It's just larger than life.
There's something to be said for classic couples done well. When they did that Hawkeye Mockingbird miniseries back in the day, I liked that. A Rogue and Gambit. Like, even if I'm not a fan of the coupling in particular, there are some couples that are like, they become couples. Like, Cyclops and Jean Grey will always be a couple. And Colossus and Kitty Pryde. Like, that's one of the things that X-Men Gold has done well, is taken a classic couple. Even if it's not the coupling, like, I never wanted Colossus and Kitty Pryde to be, like, a destined couple.
Right.
But when you do it well, it's kind of hard to argue with. And this is that done well.
Right.
There's also a cool infiltration scene.
Yeah. And you need that with Gambit.
You do.
Yep.
Dave?
Right, I'm sticking with the superhero vibe and kind of an unusual one this month. I picked up a book randomly from DC just because I would just want to see what's going on in it and check the art. This is Green Lanterns, number 40. It is the start of a new storyline.
and ended up really liking the issue. This is written by Tim Seeley, who we've liked before for his horror action series, yeah. Hack Slash. And
did a great run on Nightwing to start off the Rebirth stuff.
And he did Revival.
Revival. Was the one, other one I was trying to remember. But yeah, that was his Nightwing and then Grayson series were both awesome. And by the way, he touches on something from Grayson here. There was one of those little balloons that's like, see Grayson number 3 or whatever. And I kind of always liked that. Anyway, this is the kind of buddy cop, buddy Green Lantern comic that has Simon Baz?
Yeah, sure.
And Jessica Cruz in it as the early on they were definitely in the we don't like each other phase. I haven't read it for a year or two. They're definitely now in the, hey, we're pretty cool with each other. She's like, yeah, I know that you kind of present yourself as kind of a jock, but you're actually kind of, it's clearly a kind of a Han Solo thing. He's like, he's all right beneath it. But in this issue, it kind of said there were any number of things that surprised me with how much I liked it. First of all, was the opening of them doing kind of natural disaster relief. They're dealing with hurricane relief for several pages, and he makes a point to talk about how it felt, feels good. This is Simon Baz, to get away from working from other superheroes. People helping out against, he says, a simple enemy, no politics, no complications, just getting to use the rings for simple hero stuff. And what's kind of cool is, you see them doing actually some pretty neat things just in this montage, and they're working alongside other heroes, like you see Firestorm in there, Blue Beetle, and one somewhat obscure hero, the Bulleteer, who... I don't know. I want to say, Morrison, of course, in his Seven Soldiers series about 10 years ago or whatever it was, you tried to revive this kind of weird Golden Age character.
Yeah, that is actually... She's from the Shazam universe.
Right.
And that actually is the Seven Soldiers design of the character.
And while they're... and she has a role to play in this. She comes over and she sees Simon and she's like... she asks him if he's the one who went out with some hero named Night Pilot, who I've never heard of, and we're not supposed to have. And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, yeah, we went out a little bit, and we didn't quite click. And over the course of this, you find out that there is a app called Caper, which is a dating app for superheroes, made complete sense.
That is awesome.
his explanation of it here... He says he's telling Jessica about this. He says it's a dating app exclusively for superheroes. You post your name, city, interests, and power set. Then you followed up with your best press shots and hottest selfies. No real names allowed. And he says the idea is that it's easier to date amongst other heroes who can understand your lifestyle rather than having to go through the whole civilian superhero romance, which is always doomed, and I was like, that's pretty smart, actually.
I love it.
But there is a thing going on here. There's some missing people related to it. It's not resolved in this issue, but several heroes, none of whom you've heard of because they're kind of more minor local heroes and stuff like that, but actually sounded kind of cool, and some of them had I think intentionally lame names, a little Legion of Substitute Heroes or Legion Tryout style.
Well, I see the storyline is called Superhuman Trafficking, so I have a guess as to what's going on.
Right. And the cover shows a bunch of people captured on there.
Yeah.
And there is an inclusion here of a link to... Well, I don't want to say. There's a big reveal near the end who's behind it. I'm tempted to actually tell you because it's related to a notable writer at DC, but I'm not going to say who it is.
It's revealed that Geoff Johns is kidnapping superheroes. It's weirdly meta.
I slightly worried that I like the idea of this app. And I think that they should occasionally do more with it, and other DC comics should do some more with it occasionally. That the very first storyline about it is kind of about it going wrong, might preclude that. They do mention that there's security cautions in super encrypted this and that.
I think they should have Cyborg who runs the encryption or something like that.
I'm showing you guys off, Mike, what it's related to.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Oh.
Anyway, that's what it has ties to. And I'm not quite sure where they're going. That's the big mystery. But I like seeing the characters in this. Simon and Jessica are I don't think they're like
they don't pop out to me as great characters, but they're interesting enough, and I like them together.
Yeah.
And this was a cool... Tim Seeley is writing a good storyline. This is his kind of stuff.
Who's doing the art? I thought it was really nice, too.
Yeah, the art was, which was kind of what led me to look at it in the first place, is somebody I've never heard of, Barnaby Bagenda.
That's a made-up name.
Sounds made up. Sounds too alliterative. He's probably an actual superhero himself.
Yep.
but yeah, if you're kind of, if, you know, you've been just, like, looking for maybe a chance to read some Green Lantern stories, or you like the idea of the... of seeing this mystery related to the superhero dating app, check this issue out. Seeley, there were like five or six scenes in there, so I was like, oh, that's really cool. Oh, what a cool thing. And it's been a while since I've read a Green Lantern comic and had that vibe.
Yeah. Dave, backup pick?
Backup pick is on a more serious tip here, the prequel to a graphic novel that you told me came out from Vertigo previously.
Yeah, it's out again this week.
So the graphic novel was called... was the portmanteau word incognito, like incognito, negro. It is about a light-skinned black man in the 1920s who kind of uses his features, his lighter skin tone, mm-hmm. to poke around in society. He's a reporter and kind of do detective type stuff. And obviously, you know, race is very front and center as far as the concept of it. Now, I haven't read the graphic novel that launched it, and this is a prequel to that. And so I don't know quite how the character changes or whatever by that time. Oh, by the way, there's really nice art in this from Warren Pleece, who I've liked before. He does real kind of clean style that reminds me of, I'm going to say, like, Chris Sprouse and... Oh, even like Paul Smith and some other guys like that. But in this issue, there's kind of he is a kind of cub reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a cub reporter who doesn't have a lot of juice yet, basically, in his role. But he's been invited along with a friend. They're kind of crashing a party that's a literary party,
mm-hmm.
but it's a guy who's for the book he's writing. Was trying to, it clearly has like a cast of characters that includes a lot of black folks. And so he's been researching it, kind of hanging out and trying to get the inside scoop on that life.
Mm-hmm.
And there is definitely a suggestion that he's kind of co-opting the black life for his literary work here. And the whole issue is mostly set in... I mean, it is entirely set in and around the party. You've got your lead character who has the... what is his name? It's a very kind of alliterative name itself. Hell, I can't find it now that I'm looking for it. Shit. Zane Pinchback. There we go. It's he and his buddy kind of going through this party, and... They're talking about sort of other writers of the era, whether this guy is the real deal or not, whether anybody at this party is the real deal, what it's like. There's some funny stuff as they mingle with the white folks, and his friend is like, I'm going to try and score a white lady and stuff like that. And there's by the end, there is a murder that occurs. Okay. That sets the events in motion. And even before the end of the book, he's like, his friend, tells him, hey, the cops don't seem to really care about this, 'cause it's another black guy gets murdered. Mm-hmm. They're like, the cops don't seem to care about this. They would listen to a white guy. Why don't you go and just poke a little bit at the situation as a white guy? And he's like, no. He's like, I'm not ashamed of who I am, or, I'm not gonna betray my race just for novelty. And he's like, no, he's like, you can use this, and in fact, if you don't use it, then you're missing a huge opportunity to do something good.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decides, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. And there's some great sort of serious scenes where he's talking to people at the party who confide racist things in him. The cop says something horrible when he intimates that what they see might not be a suicide, but might be a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, I saw this guy. I met this guy earlier in the evening, and he seemed, he did not seem depressed at all. He did not seem like he would kill himself. And the cop kind of whispers to him, and he's like, You know, you can't know how these jungle bunnies think. He's like, we can't understand them. It's a suicide. He's like, all you got to do is make sure the owner, let's keep the owner of the house and the place happy and just call it a night. And it's really horrible. But it rang true, and the characters are interesting, and the situation and the 20s atmosphere of it all, and like this the Renaissance, I'm sure, and it refers to the Harlem Renaissance going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little bit steeped in at times in sort of like not the literature of the era, but those kind of come up because these guys are both aware of them. Anyway, it's a good first issue, and it makes me want to read the graphic novel. So one light pick this week with Green Lanterns, and one somewhat more serious but still a mystery comic at its heart book with Incognito Renaissance.
Nick?
My backup pick is a sort of an odd one. It is Venom number 161.
Picking all kinds of books we don't normally pick.
I know. Well, I was kind of... This is the first part of a story called Tangled Webs, and I just randomly flipped through it. I think I sort of experienced what you, Dave, with Green Lanterns.
Something visual
did.
Grabbed you?
Visually, I was into Javier Garon's art, which I think is quite nice. And he draws a pretty cool-looking symbiote, I have to say. Very clean-lined, kind of Jim Chung-ish.
Yeah.
But Mike Costa, who wrote like the G.I. Joe Cobra and various other things.
Yeah, some good stuff under his.
Kind of is giving the book a little bit more than I was expecting. And, you know, Eddie Brock is back. It was revealed that the symbiote previous to this, when he was bonding to other people, was kind of... didn't have, like, Alzheimer's, but he was definitely unstable. Like, mentally unstable.
The symbiote itself.
The symbiote itself, which was kind of...
I guess when the symbiote goes full Venom, I think of it as kind of asserting itself. But otherwise, I don't really think of the symbiote as having, like, a personality other than, I want to eat your brains.
But it is an alien.
Yeah.
And
it wasn't, like, all there?
It wasn't completely all there. However, I guess Eddie Brock was working with some other corporation, and they've cured it. So
yeah, that was during the Venom story that they just did.
Okay,
that's actually pretty interesting.
So it is a more in control Eddie and the suit working in tandem. The suit definitely wants to be a hero. It doesn't quite understand all the nuances of human, emotional stuff. So it doesn't quite know how to, you know, tell good from evil. Like, why is this woman who's berating you, who's Eddie's boss at a newspaper, because he's back to doing that job.
Is it like, why is that person not a villain?
Yeah, why is that person not a villain? And why are they treating you like this, and we should not want to do something about it?
That's an interesting way, that's actually an interesting idea, like, you know, this everyday life thing is like, well, that person is a villain to me.
Yeah, I think everybody knows that bosses at places are villains.
Yes.
Always.
But it also has, there is a jokey instance where a very Z-list villain, that Venom is taken out before.
Is that the looter?
It is the looter.
Nice.
I don't even know who that is.
Really? He's an early Spidey villain.
Yeah, runs across him. And of course, I guess Venom's last altercation with him did not go exactly well.
It seems like it'd be a bad time for the looter.
But this time Venom is like, we will not kill you. We will not eat you. We will not eat your brain. We're just going to take you to the cops. And he's like, I don't believe you. Don't eat me. And it is kind of sad.
I think the looter got his power from like a meteorite falling on him or something.
But
turns him into a super looter.
I believe he was a high school teacher who got the meteorite powers.
So watch those high school teachers.
Yeah.
So there is sort of that kind of Nova where he's talking to himself, or like Nova and World Mind, that kind of thing going on between the symbiote
and
Eddie Brock.
Between them and stuff.
There's more to Eddie Brock, which I like. And also in this issue, we get to see more of the Marvel Universe at play, because Spider-Woman makes a guest appearance. And sort of, because Eddie is definitely
a wanted
thing.
Guest appearances. That was one of the things I like most about Green Lantern, is seeing like the other heroes in there, especially somebody as relatively obscure as the Bulleteer, but played completely straight and not as like a joke or anything.
Yeah, and Spider-Woman's not as obscure as
Bulleteer. She's definitely more notable.
But again, their fight, and it is a fight, there's more to it. There's not
Brock,
just...
if not a sociopath, he had... problems.
He had problems.
I think he had he was like emotionally unstable, because I don't think he ever was like outright... evil.
He was a bad guy, though.
He was hyper jealous of Parker.
He was a plagiarist.
Yeah,
right.
He took credit for other people's work, and
but he wasn't like a sociopath like Cletus Cassidy
or
anything along those lines.
Not a good guy.
Yeah, when you decide that you want to kill the guy who's maybe doing better than you, usually something's off with you. But that said, I can imagine over the years that if they wanted to, and it seems like they do, he seems like he's gotten some kind of treatment and is a better place.
He seems
like a redeemable. It's within redemption because you could argue that a lot of his deadlier stuff was the symbiote.
Right, and I think that's sort of where it's come. I like that.
That's what I do with my life. That wasn't me. That was the symbiote.
I like them fleshing out Eddie Brock more as a character as opposed to just it all being about Venom.
He was way back when he was a photographer.
He was a photographer.
Yeah. Yep.
That's not a thing anymore.
No, he does. He actually is writing articles for another paper, which I thought was kind of cool. But yeah,
no. The symbiote did it.
Yes, the symbiote did it. No, but I was very entertained, and definitely think people should check this out.
Yeah, like when a story like this or Green Lantern kind of comes out that surprises me, and I'm like, oh, these characters who I haven't been paying attention to, but I have some fondness for, they got something cool going on.
My other pick is Armstrong and the Vault of Spirits, which does not refer to ghosts, but to wine.
That is Armstrong of Archer and
Fame? Yes, this is from Valiant Comics. This is one of those one-shots they do every now and then, where basically the premise is that Armstrong has this vault of wine from, like, going back to biblical times, because that's all he's been around, that opens once a year, because if it opens once a year, he'll drink all of it.
Yeah.
And so he gathers some friends. He gathers Armstrong gathers Archer, Quantum and Woody, the voodoo priestess Punk Mambo, and of course Faith, all together to sort of have a night of, like, trying out these fancy wines. And while he does this, it flashes back to an early wine he developed with Noah. So we see the Noah and the Ark story from the point of view of Armstrong.
This is a fantastic premise for a comic, by the way.
And it's executed beautifully.
It really is.
There's a group of various conspiracies watching him, waiting for the vault to open, because when the vault opens, these conspiracies are going to steal the wines. Now, for various reasons. And one of them is they worship the god Bacchus, and they want to get a... They want to get wine that he bottled when he was hanging with Bacchus so that they can have level whole cities with their parties.
The third party cracked me up the
and
most.
One of them is the Knights Templar, who want to get wine from the Last Supper, where apparently Armstrong was a server who spilled wine on Jesus. and then finally, the Wolves of Wall Street, who want to sell the bottle on eBay and finance their latest infernal public offering.
Yeah, I thought they were great.
Pretty good. Who's the writer on this?
This is Fred Van Lente. Who wrote the Archer and Armstrong stuff when it first started Valiant. There's also a sort of nice, sweet family story here with Archer, with Armstrong and his brothers, as well as an action story as the cultists get involved, and a funny riff on exactly who is the mastermind of this whole heist.
And then you're not saying these are literally separate stories, just the little parts of the story.
Yeah, it's all one story,
right?
But there's a lot of stuff to it.
Gotcha.
And it's just a really fun, entertaining one shot. I never know what to expect from these, but this was a great story that has a lot to offer. And is a good sort of sampler of Valiant if you've never read the Valiant stuff.
I was going
to
say, I think these are perfect things if you've never read Valiant and maybe been intrigued by it.
Yeah.
It's a good one to sort of come in and then maybe find some characters and branch off into more of this.
Are you interested in an immortal drunkard brawler?
I love the fact that Archer is basically walking around with his hands in his ears, not listening to... Armstrong's lies, essentially, about Noah.
All the stories he's telling about the Bible. Yeah.
It's pretty great.
Also on my stack this week, this is a good week for me. Amazing Spider-Man 795, which is a story called Threat Level Red, which is, I believe, kicking off the final Dan Slott story. Guest stars Loki, and is a really good story. X-Men Gold number 21, which starts off a new story revealing some secrets of the Brotherhood of Mutants from the first story arc. Also has some good stuff with Rachel Gray and a couple notable change-ups in the team lineup for X-Men Gold. Runaways number 6 racks up that final story arc. There's some fun stuff. I really feel like, although Rainbow Rowell has all the characters, she may be doing the best old lace I've ever seen.
Yeah.
There's some fun old lace moments. Daredevil number 598 is more of Daredevil working inside the King Mayor Fisk to try and bring him down from the inside. Also brings back Muse, the sort of super psychotic inhuman artist, which is used very well here. Hawkeye number 15 is the penultimate issue of that run, which has the Hawkeyes teaming up. Avengers No Surrender number 5, which is more of the big multi-part Avengers story, and reveals the nature of the villain in an interesting way. Not going to acknowledge you. Pacific Rim Aftermath number 2 is more of sort of a Hannibal Chow's goons trying to get stuff out of fallen Jaegers and kaiju. It's a solid solid Pacific Rim story. Mother Panic Batman is another bonkers part of the Milk Wars story. Mm-hmm. I have not read Mother Panic, so a lot of this was very strange to me, but I really liked it, and Ty Templeton's on art, so it's really nice. And then there's an anthology called Young Monsters in Love, which is another one of these anthologies DC did. A lot of good creative teams, a lot of great art, and some weird stuff. It's like Swamp Thing, Solomon Grundy, Dead Man, Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, a Monster Mala, and the Brain.
They're all monsters.
The Demon, Eye Vampire, and they're all, there's some really good stuff. Like the Man Bat story that opens it by Kyle Higgins and Kelly Jones is actually really good and really, really sort of tragic.
For the record, by the way, when I made the sign for this, I clearly misread the ad for it. And I said that Paul Dini wrote the whole thing, but he just wrote one of the stories.
Did he write any of the stories?
He wrote a Dead Man story.
He did. Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, it's somewhere on this side.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's by Gillian March doing the art. Yeah. This is really good. A lot of good creators, a lot of good short stories. I like these anthology books, and I thought this was a good one. I was not expecting it to be. Dave, what else is on your list?
Let's see. I think you hit most of them. Let's see. There's a new Adam Warlock comic called Infinity Countdown. Adam Warlock. I actually don't know what this is a full lead into. I didn't get a chance to read the whole thing.
It leads to Infinity Countdown. Is it called Infinity Countdown?
It is.
It's their big cosmic storyline.
Okay. And so here's the interesting thing for me. Since Mike Allred's doing the art, it has that retro approach, and you know, it looks like the 60s incarnation of the characters,
yep.
or even when there's modern versions, it still looks like a 60s incarnation because that's who Mike Allred is.
Yep.
But what I was going to say is, I actually kind of, as I started to read it, not really expecting to be interested in it, found myself kind of enjoying it, at least in part because it does a full recap of Adam Warlock's life. So if, like me, you either kind of only tangentially know him, or maybe know nothing at all, you're going to get it covered here. It's going to look like an old 60s comic, so that might freak you out, but but actually it looked kind of interesting, and I was kind of interested in like the sheer cosmicness of it all. Kang being involved. Yes, there's Rama Tut in here too. That's some weird stuff. And at one point he says, "Sleep, curs." Which is pretty cool. anyway, I have not read the whole thing, but I intend to. And I guess it's the lead into to the big Infinity thing. There's a new comic from Image called Versus, which is about this future where like war is like a spectator sport, and like the celebrities are mercenaries and stuff like that. And I think it has to do with like how the mercenaries that are the top ones, the present top ones, are feeling the heat when a new batch of mercenaries gets brought online. Anyway, it also has beautiful art, so it has that European look, that painted European art look that's super awesome looking, but I have not read it yet. And Nick, I'll leave this one to you, as I think you actually read it.
I did.
And it's a DC book, so you have to cover it.
Sure. I have a few more to add. The one Dave is talking to is Swamp Thing Winter Special.
Mm-hmm.
This is, Tom King, Jason Fabok, and the doing a story.
It's a big old 80-page giant, as they
call it. It is. Sort of a singular story about Swamp Thing and a small child that he's sort of protecting from a winter monster.
It's Swamp Thing out of his normal swampy environment. He's in he's literally a blizzard kind of thing.
Yeah, and how that sort of affects the green, which affects him. There's also, I guess, a reprint. Is that right?
Although I think it's an Kelly Jones would not have been around when Len Wein wrote his last Swamp Thing story. But my understanding is that this is like the unpublished last Swamp Thing story from Len Wein.
Yeah.
Who created the character?
Mm-hmm.
Len Wein died recently.
Yep.
And my guess is that this book began as like a tribute to him and kind of just emerged as like. Or they build it as the Swamp Thing special.
Right.
But it is, in many ways, a tribute to him. There's even a nice piece of art in the back that was co-commissioned by Marvel and DC. It has Wolverine in it, too.
Yep, yep.
I was a little shocked to see Wolverine just larger than life in a DC comic. But it's just a pinup.
But is there?
Yeah. But it's neat, and it's got a great version of Len himself in there.
And like all things Tom King, there's more to the story than what it's on the surface.
Right, it's kind of a, it's a character study, and it's there's some,
but it's also a love letter to Bernie Wrightson and Lynn Wein as well.
Right, yeah, both of whom passed recently.
Recently. Then I've got Superman number 40, which is the start of a new story arc called The Last Days. Basically,
Setting up the last days before Bendis.
But basically, Superman and his son sort of saving a dying planet, because that's something that
super fathers and super sons do.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I Hate Fairyland number 16. Finally, it comes back from hiatus. Scotty Young continues to write Gertrude, but now she's dead and in hell and trying to figure out a way out of it.
Should it be called I Hate Hell then?
I'm sure. But, you know, then there's a fifth issue of Batman White Knight. We see Batman fall further down the rabbit hole of insanity. Their Joker may or may not be as good as it seems. But there is some great stuff with Harley Quinn, the original Harley Quinn. And
Is that going to be the net result of all of this? Is that, like, he's going to become the new Harley Quinn writer or something like that?
I mean, I don't know about that. But I would actually really like DC to acknowledge take this idea and kind of run with it. I like the notion of two different...
It'd be fascinating if they did, but, like, it seemed like it'd be the biggest slap in the face to... Jimmy Palmiotti. Because isn't the whole notion that there is the original Harley Quinn, who we kind of... is really the kind of animated series one.
Yeah.
And that the newer Roller Girl one that they've had for, like, what, 5-6 years now, if not more? Since, like, New 52. Is it an imposter?
Well, I mean, she's Harley Quinn in the sense that...
People have liked that series. We haven't loved it, but it's done all right for them.
But there's some cool stuff in there, and Sean Murphy gets to draw some cool action scenes. And then
His art is gorgeous. Whenever I'm not following the book, but that art is super sweet.
And then my last book is Batman number 40, which is the second and final part to the Wonder Woman and Batman crossover.
How many horses did they kill?
I knew you were going to ask that. No horses have died. No animals die. Lots of people die, but actually they're called they're hordes of creatures. So I guess technically animals.
He couldn't kill a
animals.
Horse, so he killed a horde.
Sure, but it's sort of about Wonder Woman and Batman's relationship.
You said Wonder Woman.
Yeah, she's it's basically. No.
Not Catwoman.
Oh, okay.
Well, that engagement really didn't last, huh?
Well, it tangentially deals with Selina and Bruce's relationship as well, but...
So Wonder Woman is his side piece.
Nick, you just continue on. I understand you mean relationship in a broader term.
In a broader term, yes.
But what fun would that be? It's not a podcast if I don't misinterpret what Nick is saying about Batman.
That's true. But...
What is he punching there?
It's a horde. It's an animal. Basically, okay. Wonder Woman.
I thought it was a dinosaur or something.
Wonder Woman and Batman are in sort of an alternate dimension, fighting a never-ending horde of monsters.
Yep.
Sort of happens. Sort of taking the place of a defender of reality, because Batman offered to do it once, it's just so this guy can see his wife.
I'm gonna nod.
So
you know, you remember when everyone was like, it's not too long, it was like maybe 10 years ago, when everyone was like poo-pooing the Batman that used to fly around the UFOs and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I feel like Morrison brought that back and there's no putting it back in the box.
But again, Tom King takes that
Brave
kind
and the
of,
Bold arguably did
yeah,
too.
Takes true. That kind of crazy idea and puts it down to earth
a little bit. It's a human story behind the
exactly.
UFO.
And I think there's some great stuff between the two characters and ultimately between Bruce and Selina. So it is kind of comes full circle. But that is all that I've got. All
right. That'll wrap up our comic talk for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk a couple of board games and a movie. All right. Dave, you were going to talk about a much anticipated board game you got to play.
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk about this game that we don't have.
Right. And may never have again.
And may never have again. It was a big Kickstarter. It was called Gloomhaven.
Yep.
When it was first orderable, it's expensive. It's like, what, $160 or something
it's
like that?
Super expensive.
And we're like, but it had an interesting sounding premise. It took the legacy concept of games like Pandemic Legacy and applied it to essentially a dungeon crawl. It has it's about like you control mercenary characters that go down and you have kind of elaborate strategic battles and stuff like that, and they live and die and gain power and stuff like that, and a story unfolds and a map unfolds over time of this fantasy kingdom that's kind of a darker one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, when we initially ordered it, of course, we were like, games that are $160 do not traditionally sell a whole lot.
No.
And we're like, well, let's order one because, you know, it's an interesting-sounding premise.
Right.
Then in the span between that and when it came out, suddenly it started to get all this buzz. People were saying it's really good. And, like, by the time it came out, at which point we can no longer, you know, in the months before, raise our numbers.
Mm-hmm.
everybody's like, do you have it? Do you have it? And I'm like, we got one.
Yep.
And we had a special order way back, and so I'm sorry, it's all we can do.
Yep.
Anyway, maybe it'll come back. Maybe it won't. Maybe you've got a friend who's got it that you could get it on their game.
If you have gamer friends, I have at least four gamer friends who own this game.
What's tricky, though, is that it is as a legacy game, it's a one-time playthrough of sorts.
Yep.
Although I imagine, you know, as we saw, like, when we were playing Pandemic Legacy, when Nick couldn't make it a certain night, we would have somebody sub in for him and stuff like that. So it's not like you can't, you know, that there aren't some options like that. I really enjoyed the game. I found it is worth the hype. It is a little complex. I'm glad I watched a couple videos on YouTube before we dove right in. And even then, the first game was for sure a learning experience. You're playing slightly unusual kind of race class combos. They're not... don't necessarily correspond with, like, you know, your usual fighter, rogue thing and cleric and stuff like that. So I was playing the two-player version of this. I believe it's you can play 1-4, I think.
Okay.
And my brother is playing this kind of like, they have original races. This is kind of like rock men sort of guys, but they can like control, like, they have some elemental abilities. And so think like the Thing from the FF, big, strong, tough guy, but also with some elemental powers. Not just rock and earth stuff, but like air and ice and, you know, the other elements. I was playing a sort of a little rat man kind of guy from this kind of like, honestly, kind of creepy sounding like a race of rat men who occasionally develop these psychic powers and ability to control other vermin and rats, and they tend to be like sort of predatory assassins and stuff like that. So we picked our characters. You do give them names and stuff like that. You draw a card that's your secret goal. Which is kind of neat. That's like, you're not supposed to tell the other player, but this is what you are secretly, even though it's a cooperative game, you do have a sort of secret goal. And like, I will tell you, like, one of the ones I had that I did not, you get to pick two, or you draw two and you pick one. The one I did not choose for my little evil rat man was the pious one, which is that you're supposed to, as you gather treasure and stuff, gather up like 100 gold pieces or 1,000 gold pieces to because you're on a redemption arc and you want to get in good with the temple in the central city of Gloomhaven. And donate it to like the church and fund, you know, like a new cathedral or whatever for them, and basically get right with God. And I was like, it actually sounded like, you know, fun too.
Yeah.
But I did not choose that one. It did not quite seem to fit in.
Right.
The actual game, what you do, and there's like, we bought gear before we went out, so there's like a market in town. They have some suggestions on what you might want to pick up, so it's you don't go in completely blind.
Mm.
And then there's basically a deck of cards that contain your moves in combat. And the cards are a little bit complex to read. They have a lot of icons. Once you know what the icons mean, they're not complex, but a little bit of a learning curve on that. They have a top and bottom to each card. On your turn, you can play one move from the top and one move from the bottom. You play two cards, one top, one bottom.
Okay.
Basically, top tends to be attack, bottom tends to be a move, but sometimes that move is like a charge or some special attack. So you can find ways of doing like sort of double moves or double attacks. And the meat of it, there is a world map, but most of the time you're in some sort of dungeon, and you've got tiles that you lay out according to a book. So think Mansions of Madness.
Okay.
Or any of those games that are where you lay out tiles. I guess Betrayal at House on the Hill would be another one. And you put the monsters out, and you fight the monsters, and you have to actually do things. It's weirdly strategic in ways and like kind of slightly abstract. Like, there are cards that allow you to loot, To grab the loot, because like when you complete your mission, you just it's like you disappear from the dungeon as if it's a video game.
Okay.
So you can pick up like treasure, which every monster that dies, they drop a sort of auto drop a little piece of treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you end your turn on one of those, like you auto pick it up, but sometimes you'll take out a few monsters or something like that, and there'll be several around you. And because the cards, kind of as you use them and burn them, some of them, the big powers permanently go away, and you have to like you have a relatively small hand of choices, and you'll when you can't play any more cards, your character's exhausted and you have to leave the dungeon. So you can't stick around too much in a room like collecting treasure even.
Okay.
That's where that loot card, like you can do a thing where like anything in sort of a perimeter around you, you auto-collect if you play the loot ability. But otherwise, you have to just land on it. And so you strategically pick up treasure sometimes. It was fascinating, the tactics that we were coming up with. And very cool how it works sometimes. Even in the first game, I was like, we were really like kind of micromanaging some stuff that we were doing in really interesting ways to deal with, like, you know, how are we going to like, oh, we can do this to pin down their archer in the back so he can't move and get within range of us. How are we going to take out these guys up front when I need to heal? What can you do to buy me some time? It was really interesting strategy, and that's right out of the gate. As the game goes, you'll build up your hand. Not into necessarily, you won't have more cards, but you'll replace cards with new, better cards. Hmm. And he had powers that had to do with elements. I had powers where I could summon rats, take people over, you know, so that they attack their own allies and stuff like that. And all the characters have weird and unusual powers. So we just did the first mission. We kind of just scraped by. It was actually pretty exciting. While I was playing it, I saw that one of our friends, Dan Nguyen, was playing with his friends, and we both agreed it was a really fun first playthrough. Hmm. And pretty tough in the first mission, but kind of in a cool way. So I am highly recommending this game, Gloomhaven.
If we ever get it,
or if you've got a friend who's got it, or if you can turn it up on the black market.
I am also going to recommend a game we don't currently carry.
Yes, but we might.
However, we might. I'm reaching out to them about a wholesale inquiry. We're looking. And it is a game you might have heard of called What Do You Meme? And it's very Cards Against Humanity-esque. Basically, you have a little easel. You have pictures of various memes from online. Everything from like the sort of half-smiling old man looks nervous.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I love that one.
Recognizable memes. So it's just a picture. And then there's a bunch of purple cards. Everybody has seven cards that are like, when you, for example, one of the ones I played last night when I was playing was when you don't have a good answer for the meme and what do you meme, which I feel was like a trump card.
Yeah.
But there was, there's a bunch. It's got some fairly dirty ones because it is an adult party game. I actually like this better than Cards Against Humanity. I think it's funnier and the visual component definitely adds to it.
A little less reliant on just kind of like, I'm naughty boy.
The dirtiest thing you can say. Yeah, there's some cleverness to it. So it, you put up a meme, and the stack of memes, it's like 150 cards. It's a ton. You put a picture up on the easel, then everybody else submits a card, and then you read them all aloud, and you pick the one you like the best. Very much in the vein of a lot of these party games.
Yeah, red flags.
Yeah.
And, Cards Against and all that.
But it's a really fun take on it. We're trying to get it in, and I definitely recommend it.
I'm very excited to find out the old guy is in there.
There's a lot of the girl who set the house on fire, that's on there too.
Wow.
Yeah, like all the recognizable memes are in there. As we were playing, one of my friends, she knew like all the memes.
They don't by chance have smiling Leo in there, do they?
I don't know if I've seen that. I don't know if I saw that one yet, actually.
That one might actually have some copyright issues.
Maybe, but I'm not sure. There's lots of stuff in there.
Sad Keanu.
There's also expansion packs, which I haven't gotten yet.
Yeah, Sad Keanu would be a great one. They could maybe do a celebrity expansion pack.
I think there is a celebrity expansion pack. There's one called the Basic Bitch expansion, which is all like Kardashians and stuff. There's one that's a Game of Thrones memes expansion pack.
Oh,
so we're going to try and get all the expansions as well. We'll just see. Nick, you were going to mention a movie?
Yeah, there are many movies in the wilds of Netflix.
Uh-huh.
But every once in a while I go on an exploratory mission looking for good new ones.
And sometimes you find mediocre new ones.
Yeah, I do find mediocre. This one actually was better than mediocre. Okay. It was actually quite good.
Oh, I just realized, I thought for a minute, I know what you're going to talk about, but I thought you were going to talk about that Cloverfield movie.
No, because we haven't watched it yet.
Right. Well, Nick, did you not
watch it? I know I watched it.
Yeah, but I thought I might watch it. We might all talk
about
it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that'll be for future.
That was a fascinating, like, just experiment in, like, sort of viral, like, Uber marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the movie you did watch, though.
It is a movie called The Monster, which was a 2016 indie horror from a director, Brian Bertino, which I'm not super familiar with his work, but he did The Strangers, which I know. I think it was that home invasion thing, it was kind of well received.
I don't quite remember what that one was, but now, sure, whatever.
But it's a pretty small, simple premise about a mother and a daughter have very strange relationship. Zoe Kazan plays the mom. She's kind of an alcoholic, not really nice to her young daughter, but they're basically going on a road trip to take her to her father. She wants to live there from now on. In the middle of this, their car gets hit. They think it's some kind of animal. There's a dead wolf on the road. But things are not as old as they seem.
Is it like something was eating that wolf or something?
Yes, monsters are real. And it's sort of...
I was double checking. I was like, "Is the monster a metaphor for
the no?" In this one, I will
alcoholism
outright,
or something.
I will outright say the monster is not a metaphor. It is not. It is a real thing.
Every once in a while,
thing.
I like those stories, but sometimes they're a little heavy-handed. Yeah. So I was like, "Okay."
Well, I mean,
I was relieved to hear the monster is.
I mean, the Babadook is kind of one of those
example of well done, but I've also seen it. But it's also even that is a little on the nose at times,
and it can be heavy-handed. This one is just sort of a good kind of claustrophobic fun. I was talking with Dave, and a couple of years ago, you showed me that Emily Blunt horror movie.
Yeah, kind of a lesser-known movie called Windchill.
Windchill, which I think just popped up on, if you have Stars, you can get through on there.
About a couple of college students sharing a ride. They don't really know each other. They share a ride home for, like, winter vacation, winter break. And they take some back roads, and the car breaks down, and something weird happens.
Yeah,
and there's some relationship stuff in it because like he has a unspoken thing for her, and there's a question of like whether he's a dangerous guy because he does kind of come across pretty
right. But yeah, this is sort of just got that claustrophobic horror with a monster. It's got good creature effects.
Sounds very up my alley.
Yeah, it was. I don't want to go into too much more because I don't want to spoil things.
Right. Do I kill the monster? No.
I'm not going to say. But I definitely recommend this one. And
it is just called
The Monster.
The Monster.
He also did a movie called Black Coat's Daughter, which I know is making the rounds as a. It's also on Netflix or it might be Amazon Prime. I can't remember. But our friend Jeff Fillion, I think, watched that and quite liked it.
Okay.
So it's on my list. Of
just Sometimes Not Crazy.
Sometimes those Prometheus.
There is that. You know.
Everybody gets one.
I think he.
He also liked the new Aliens movie.
Oh, did he? I thought he was just lukewarm on that
maybe
one.
Maybe not.
Regardless.
Was he like, it's no Prometheus? I feel like he said that.
Yeah, I can't
even tell how much he's just messing with us at this point.
At this point, I feel like
that's
a nice element to it, because he knows how much we hated that movie. But yeah, no. Check this one out.
All right. That wraps it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.